One day the widow of a member of the group of prophets came to Elisha and cried out, "My husband who served you is dead. And you know how he feared the Lord. But now a creditor has come threatening to take my two sons as slaves. What can I do to help you?" Elisha asked. "Tell me, what do you have in the house?" "Nothing at all except a flask of olive oil," she replied. Elisha said, "Borrow as many empty jars as you can from your friends and neighbors. Go into your house with your sons, shut the door behind you, pour olive oil from your flask into the jars, setting each one aside when it's filled." So she did as she was told. Her sons kept bringing jars to her, and she filled one after another. Soon every container was full to the brim. "Bring me another jar," she said to one of her sons. "There aren't any more," he told her. And then the olive oil stopped flowing. We're going to talk about this Twilight Zone story. It's interesting, but I want to start this way. I saw a list recently of the top 10 things people we like to hang around, characteristics of top 10 people we like to hang around. So then I thought, well, there's got to be a list of the people we don't want to hang around to, and there is. So you can decide which list you're on, all right? I'm not making any judgments, although if you want any help, I can probably tell you which list you belong on. Here's the top 10 people we want to be around. We like to be around. Number one, they know how to listen. Number two, they project confidence. Number three, they are pros at empathizing. Number four, they're reliable. Number five, they remember what you say. Number six, they have a good sense of humor. Number seven, they're inclusive. Number eight, they don't take themselves too seriously. Number nine, they treat everyone with respect. And number 10, they're easy to be around. Those are the people we like to be around. Maybe you're on that list. Or, for every yang there's a ying, maybe you're on this list, the people we don't like to be around. And I'm going to start with number two because I'm saving number one because it leads into the text. Number two, they're constantly complaining. Number three, they're always playing the victim. Number four, they don't care what you have going on. Number five, they're vulnerable. Number six, or five, they're unreliable. Number six, they never remember what you say. Number seven, they aren't fun to be around. Number eight, they want to talk about others constantly. Number nine, they're quick to judge. And number 10, they only eat at Asian Pearl. Which should have been higher on the list, by the way. Actually, number 10 was, they are always emotionally in need. And then number one on that list, they always think they can fix your problem. Doesn't it bug you when somebody who doesn't experience the problem you're experiencing, that you've been experiencing, that you've been dealing with, that you've tried everything to fix, comes up to you and says, "Well, if I were you, I'd do this." I'm not a fan of that phrase, "if I were you." You know why? You ain't ever going to be me. You ain't ever going to be me. I ain't ever going to be you. Now, you can give me advice, and I might take it, I might reject it, and vice versa, but you can't know how I feel. And you can't know what I'm going through. This woman in our story has a problem. And it's one thing when somebody thinks they can fix your problem and they can't. We have a prophet here that actually can do something about her problem. So let's break this story apart and then we'll get a practical outline together. 2 Kings 4:1, the wife of a man from the company of the prophets cried out to Elisha. So she comes to him. "Your servant, my husband, is dead. And you know that he revered the Lord, but now his creditor is coming to take my two boys as slaves." First thing I think of when I read that is, you know what? I've done a lot of bad things in my life that have put me in bad circumstances and situations. But there's times where you bad things happen to you and it wasn't your fault. Right? Not everything is your fault. This woman didn't do anything wrong. Her husband died. Now she owes what he owed to the creditors. Without going into it, it's a good place to be reminded that that's where this widow. I saw some numbers the other day. The average household credit card debt right now is $5,315. I'm actually surprised it's not higher. Total U.S. consumer debt is $14.9 trillion. Someone said the only reason many American families don't own an elephant is because they've never been offered an elephant for a dollar down and easy monthly payments. One well-refined man was bragging to an old boy from Hazard, Kentucky. He said, "We have a whole room full of furniture at our house from France that goes back to Louis XIV. And that old boy from Hazard said, "That ain't nothing." He said, "We got a house full of furniture that goes back to rent to own on the 15th. I had sort of a financial crisis in college. Did anybody else? And that was trying to figure out how to pay for it and get through. I left a message on my dorm room phone. It said, "Hi, this is Mark. If it's the phone company, I sent the money. If it's mom and dad, please send money. If it's the financial office, you didn't loan me enough money. And if it's my girlfriend, leave a message and don't worry, I got plenty of money." Have you ever noticed, because I have, that life doesn't make allowances for your crisis? Universe doesn't send out a memo to my church family when I'm going through something to say, "Hey, be nice to Mark today. He's had a tough go." Doesn't work like that, does it? Life doesn't work that way. So this lady had the bills that were due, but her husband had died, and she couldn't take care of them. Now, we don't know a lot about her. Some scholars believe, and it makes sense to me, that she was married to Obadiah. You've heard that name because he's one of our Bible books, the minor prophet Obadiah, who served in the early days of Elijah and Elisha. He served in Ahab's court. He had to deal with King Jezebel, who then had many of those prophets put to death. So this could be Mrs. Obadiah. So this story, though, has played out hundreds of times, even around the world and in our church, where a poor widow lady is now somehow responsible for all of the debt that has incurred with her and her husband. Look at verse 2. This is where it starts to take a twist. Elisha replied to her, "How can I help you? Tell me, what do you have in your house?" "Your servant has nothing at all," she said, "just a small jar of olive oil." Now leave that verse up for a minute, Bill. Let's look at this. What we miss in reading the Bible is tone of voice and pauses. I always would like for my Bible to speak to me and pause where they paused and hear the tone of voice that they used when they were saying things. I can't help but wonder what this lady's tone of voice was when Elijah went from, "How can I help you?" to, "What do you have in your house?" Because she's already told him she doesn't have anything. That's why she came to him. So he says, "How can I help you?" And at that point, she's thinking he's going to get the checkbook out. He's going to take care of my problem. But no. And I wonder how long the time frame was between these two things. "How can I help you? Tell me, what do you have in your house?" Well, she's already answered that. "I came to you because I don't have anything. If I had something to sell, it would have been on eBay by now. Do I need to back up and take it from the top? I don't have anything." "What do you mean, what do I have in the house?" "Just this one small jar of olive oil." Now look at verse 3. Elisha said, "Go around and ask all your neighbors for empty jars. Don't just ask for a few." I bet she's thinking, this guy can't hear. I don't need empty jars. I need oil. I need money. I'm broke. I don't need something to put nothing in. And nothing is all I have. Verse 4. "Then go inside and shut the door after you've gathered the jars behind you and your sons. Pour oil into all the jars, and as each is filled, put it to one side." She left him, shut the door behind her and her sons. They brought the jars to her, and she kept pouring. When all the jars were full, she said to her son, "Bring me another one." But he replied, "There's not a jar left." Then the oil stopped flowing. Let's talk about this story. This miracle is about the flow of oil. Anybody know what Elisha's first miracle was? A little Bible trivia. Come on, I'll have Jimmy buy your lunch if you get this right. Steak. Elisha's first miracle? Stopping the flow of the Jordan River. That was his first miracle. So here we are several miracles in, and now he's causing the flow of oil into empty jars. And I always have trouble keeping Elisha and Elijah apart, so Elisha to me is the go-with-the-flow prophet. Stop the flow, start the flow. And he asked her, what does she have in her house? And her first instinct is to say nothing, and that led me to this outline. She does what we do. She minimized what little she had left. Now, I can't prove this, and it's not in the text, but when Elisha asked her what she has in the house and she says nothing, I wonder if he made a face. Because anytime somebody says, "I don't have anything," that's not true. You ever get that stare or that, anybody in your life that's too close of a talker for you? Raise your hand if you got close talkers that, well, maybe not, they're sitting right beside you, so that's not a good thing. There was one guy in the airport, and this lady was staring him down. It was so awkward. He had to say something to her. He said, ma'am, you've been staring at me for the last 20 minutes. He said, I'm sorry. You look just like my fourth husband. He said, well, how many times you've been married? She said, 3. I can picture Elisha. It's like she says, I don't have anything. He's like, come on. And finally she says, okay, I got a little jar of oil. Sometimes we get so scared by our scarcity that we minimize our supply. Jasmine walked into the room years ago, and she was complaining about things. And I'm not the one you want to talk to if you're going to complain very long. Because I interrupted her, and I said, don't you have anything good at all going on in your life? And she said, and this is a quote, nothing. I got nothing. So I had to remind her a few things. Well, you walked in here. There's some people couldn't do that. You got up this morning. Have you eaten yet today? Yeah. You still have eyelids. Those are important. I mean, I can make a big list. That's not nothing. You know, it's possible that we overlook the very thing that God wants to use to accomplish something good in our lives because we don't think it's anything. We think it's nothing. When you've lived with your deficit for long enough, it's easy to lose appreciation for what you do have. God never asked you to use what you don't have. Never. I don't know if you remember the name Lauren Whitehead from school. In 1983, he came up with what is known as the domino effect. His study proved that if you take a single domino and drop it into a domino that is 50% bigger, you know how that transpires. Well, regular dominoes fall in a linear progression. But Whitehead's would be described as a geometric progression. Now, what that means is this. Hang with me. In his progression, each domino is 50% bigger than the previous domino. By the time you get to the 10th domino, it would be as tall as this guy right here. 10 dominoes. So that got me to thinking. So by the time the 18th domino in this geometric progression falls, you could knock down this building right here. Now, I know my church, and I know what some of you are thinking. Well, it's already leaning, Mark. Okay. Well, let's play it all out then. By the 23rd domino, you could knock over this building. Well, I wanted to keep going. By the 57th domino, you would look down on Mount Everest. And if you want to keep going, then by the 73rd domino, you have now bridged the gap between the earth and the moon. Now, whenever I've heard this principle mentioned, it's always in regards to temptation. How it starts out with something small, and then one look, one glance, one desire, one indiscretion, and all of a sudden the dominoes fall, and you've lost your job, you've lost your good name, you've lost your family, and if you're not careful, you've lost your soul. You've heard me say it before. Once the dam breaks, you don't get to tell the water where to go. But I'm not applying this domino theory to temptation this morning or something negative. I want you to know that God can take that simple thing in your life that you really think is nothing, that insignificant thing that you take for granted and don't value, and if you will use it for God and watch Him work in your life, I've seen the dominoes fall, church, and all of a sudden what seemed little or not enough becomes abundance and blessing, and it's all because of God. And it happens all the time. One of the stories that touched my heart years ago was the story of Nora and Mr. Dan. Mr. Dan's wife died in 2016. He suffered depression, anxiety, and was about to give up on life, contemplating suicide. And one day at the grocery store, everything changed because Tara Wood brought her little daughter Nora to the store, and she spotted Mr. Dan, and she started talking to him. First thing she said was, "Hi, old person." Don't you love kids? And he replied, and they started talking, and from that conversation, a friendship blossomed, and Nora visited Mr. Dan every week for the next 4 years until he died. Mr. Dan even attended Nora's preschool graduation. Mr. Dan received his last hug from Nora the day before he died, but before he closed his eyes for the last time, he said, "You wouldn't think someone so little could have such a big impact, but that little girl saved my life." Listen, God has always made much of the little in my life. And He's done it all through the Bible, right? I mean, doing things God's way is asking Peter to get back in the boat after he's fished all night. Doing things God's way is picking up that sack lunch of fish and chips, Thomas. Doing things God's way is picking up that slingshot, David. Doing things God's way is dropping that penny in the offering plate, poor widow woman. And doing things God's way is gathering up empty jars for who knows what, but because that's God's way. The simple has the ability to invoke the miraculous. That's true of every believer. And for this widow, it was empty jars. And Elisha gives her these series of small commands. And it's easy for preachers to read over this and pass over this part, but I think it's important. He tells her to get some empty jars. That's command number one. Shut the door behind you and your boys. Number two, pour oil in the jars. As each is filled, put it to the side. So how does she do? Get some empty jars. Check. Shut the door behind you. Check. Fill the jars until there are no more. Check and set them to the side. So check, check, check. She not only did what we do and minimized what little she had left, number two, she does what we need to do. She obeyed even though she didn't understand. Yet another example of the importance of obedience to the Word of God. What if she would have said to the prophet, and this is what modern-day churchgoers say, things like this. What if she'd have said, well, I don't get this. Why can't you just twinkle your nose a little bit like Samantha Stevens on Bewitched and make oil appear? I mean, why can't you just say, let there be oil? What in the world? Why do I have to knock on my neighbor's doors and gather up empty jars for? She could have said that, and had she said that, she'd have never had any oil. I heard a debate the other day. I could not believe what I was hearing. Two preachers debating which is more important, faith or obedience. I would like to jump in on that debate to debate the ridiculousness of that debate. The widow's faith and obedience were linked. Now let's talk straight on this for a moment. James gives us in his book the line that tells us that faith without works is dead, and dead faith is useless faith. Let me tell you with all sincerity and love this morning, if you don't have enough faith to be obedient to the Word of God, then you don't have enough faith to get you to heaven. Why are we trying to separate the two? As if one doesn't prove the other. Faith is believing when I can't see it. Do you? Faith is obeying when I don't understand it. Are you? Faith is trusting when I can't comprehend it. Can you? Faith is giving when I don't think I have it. Will you? Faith is looking forward to heaven even though I can't fathom it. Faith is not just holding a belief in your head. Concrete action. It's gathering empty jars, shutting the door behind you, and pouring oil until there's no more to pour. Which brings me to my third thought. She does what we forget to do. She keeps on pouring. I hate to confess this, but a few years ago, that's several now, I tried that thing where you feel sorry for yourself. Well, I saw everybody else doing it, so I thought I'd try it too. I'm not one that normally does that, but sucks. It didn't work at all, I can tell you that. The more I did that, the more deeper I went in my deficit of discouragement. But somebody told me, and I'd learned this years ago, and I've always practiced it until I felt sorry for myself, which is, you know what, when you're down, all you need to do is try and encourage or bless or lift somebody else up, and it'll always make you feel better. That's not just a sentimental thought. That's truth. And I tried that. I thought, you know, I need to stop this, and I need to go to Riley's and visit some people or go cut my neighbor's grass, do something. And the encouraging others approach, it does make you feel better. And I wanted someone to encourage me. I've seen with people how bitterness will keep you from pouring what you have into others' lives while you're waiting for what you want. I didn't want that to be me. For all of us who call ourselves believers, this principle is always true. The more you pour, the more it flows. See, you're getting it backwards if you're waiting for it to flow before you pour. The more you pour, the more it flows. Do you believe that? Well, say it with me like you believe it. The more you pour, the more it flows. Now say it like you're not a cult being forced to say it.
The more you pour, the more it flows.
Thank you, Mark, my man. Say it again. The more you pour, the more it flows. It's so true. As long as the woman kept bringing, God kept giving. As long as she kept pouring, God kept filling. Getting out of a difficult situation is always a good thing. But sometimes people get out of one situation that's bad and find themselves in one that's worse. I remember my dad being between ministries. It's a tough transition for him. He's like me. I'm not very good sitting where you're sitting. I get fidgety. I start looking at the ceiling. Even if the sermon is really good, I'm having trouble focusing. My dad's even worse. And so he was sitting with us for the first time in my church experience between ministries. Watching my dad sit there through church was entertaining. And my mom had a rule. Of course, it never applied to Dad because he was always up front. But now it applied to him. And her rule was, once we sit down, we don't move. That's the rule. Simple rule, right? Anything you have to do, you do it before church. Because once church starts and we're there, we're not going anywhere. Well, there have to be exceptions to that, right? Not with Mom. We're standing there singing a song, and Dad's getting fidgety, and my dad, at 55, 60 years old, is starting to do that pee-pee dance. He needs to go. And he told Mom, I need to go to the bathroom, and she says, and I quote, "You know the rule." And she wouldn't budge and let him out. And he said, "Listen, I got to go to the bathroom." And she said, "If you go, you're going to set a bad example." To which he said, "If I stay here much longer, I'm going to set a bad example." So against her wishes, he goes to the bathroom. She wasn't happy, and he comes back, and he slips back into the pew, and he could feel the hostility coming from Mom, like she wanted nothing to do with his arm around her, and he thought, this is ridiculous. He put his hand on her shoulder, and she took her elbow and started grinding it into his ribs to push him away. He turned to tell her how dumb this was and realized it wasn't Mom. He climbed into the wrong pew. It is possible to make a difficult situation even worse. This widow didn't just get out of a bad situation. It's one thing to get out of a bad situation, but she got into a good situation. I mean, all this oil was going to take care of all of her debts, and she could keep her sons. And I don't want to pass over one minor detail before I wrap this up, but the part where she shuts the door, it's interesting to me. The prophet tells her to shut the door behind her, which means all this pouring took place in private. What do you make of that? I think sometimes what really matters is what you pour out in private when nobody's looking. And a lot of us are so busy praying for more oil or more healing or more opportunities, more money, and God is saying, pour, you know? When's the last time you had a good come-to-Jesus session where you just unloaded all of it? Ever? The more you pour, the more it flows. The more I've read and studied this story, the more I've come to the conclusion, I don't think it's about the oil. I think it's about the vessel. So, that got me to thinking about something Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 7. We have this treasure in jars of clay, that's us, to show that this all-surpassing power is from God and not from us. Maybe you've borrowed sugar from your neighbor or eggs or milk. Does anybody even do that anymore? Is that something that's long gone now, borrowing things from neighbors? I doubt you've ever borrowed empty jars. Why did Elisha tell her to get empty jars? It's a simple principle. God can't fill what's already full. So if he's trying to pour something into your life and you're full of yourself, or you're full of pride, or you're full of jealousy or envy or whatever it might be, your own will, can't fill a jar that's already full. I want to show you a picture of Tim Burt. He was a professional baseball player back in the day for the Expos. He got out of baseball early, and everybody kind of made fun of him because he was leaving millions of dollars on the table. But him and his wife had a passion for children, and they began to adopt kids that nobody else wanted. They adopted a little guy who had multiple seizures on a daily basis. They adopted another little boy who was born without a left hand. They adopted a little girl who required surgery after surgery for a heart defect. another boy whose feet were pointed in the wrong direction. They wanted to give these kids a chance, figuring nobody else is going to choose these children, and we need to. And one quote from this baseball player that stuck with me, Tim Burke says, "Big problems require big love." That's a picture of God choosing us, choosing children with big challenges intentionally. Why would God put something so special in something so fragile? Why would he do that? Well, the answer is in the question. He chose us clay jars, not in spite of our cracks, because of our cracks, and that will ensure that people not compliment the vessel nearly as much as they value the oil. One story that touched my heart, I'll close with this. I love this story. It's about Henry Nouwen. He was a renowned author born in the Netherlands in 1932. He wrote books that were translated in 22 different languages, over 2 million copies sold. He wrote a book entitled Return of the Prodigal, and I really, really liked that book. He spoke at Harvard, Yale, Princeton, all the prestigious institutions, but the last few years of his life, he thought, you know what, I need to focus on individual people. So he started finding these men and women who were confined to institutions because they had either physical challenges, emotional, mental challenges, and he would make appointments, this prestigious author, one-on-one with all these people who were challenged in some way. He came across a young man named Trevor, and they started corresponding and became friends. And so Dr. Nouwen said, I'm going to come where you're at, and we're going to visit. Well, the hospital got word that this famous author was coming, and all the doctors and nurses and staff wanted to meet him. So the day he arrives to meet Trevor, they usher him into this room they called the Golden Room at this specific institution, and all the hospital dignitaries, donors, doctors, staff were there. One person wasn't there, though. It was Trevor. And Dr. Nouwen asked, where's Trevor? Well, they have a policy at that hospital. The patients aren't allowed to come into the Golden Room and can't eat with the staff. And Dr. Nouwen said, well, listen, if Trevor can't eat in here, then I don't want to eat in here. I came to see Trevor. Well, they decided to make an exception. So they let Trevor come into the Golden Room to eat with Dr. Nouwen and all these highbrow people. So Trevor is excited. He's never been in the Golden Room. He's grinning from ear to ear. Dr. Nouwen turns to talk to the person on his other side, opposite Trevor, and doesn't notice that Trevor makes his way to the podium in the microphone. And Trevor immediately blows into the mic, because that's what people do when they don't speak in a mic regularly, to see if it was on. And then he said, to everyone's shock and surprise, I'd like to raise a glass to my friend, Dr. Henry Nouwen. Well, nobody knew what to do, so nobody raised a glass because they're in shock that Trevor is behind the microphone. And then he starts singing, if you're happy and you know it, raise your glass. If you're happy and you know it, raise your glass. If you're happy and you know it, then don't be afraid to show it. If you're happy and you know it, raise your glass. Well, a few people started to. Trevor wasn't going to give up. That song has 100 verses, and they all sound the same. If you're happy and you know it. So he starts singing again. Well, now a few people are starting to sing with him. If you're happy and you know it, raise your glass. And it starts to ripple. And all of a sudden, everybody's standing. And all these big donors and doctors are singing as loud as they can. If you're happy and you know it, raise your glass. If you're happy and you know it, then don't be afraid to show it. And they're like shouting now. If you're happy and you know it, raise your glass. It was amazing. All under the direction of Trevor. Nobody pretending anymore. No one worried about the rules. No one trying to separate the PhDs from the ADDs. Just a room full of joyless people overflowing with it in abundance because a wounded healer named Henry lived among the challenged, and a challenged man named Trevor was willing to pour out the joy he had so that others could discover the joy they'd been missing. He poured out a little bit, and it filled an entire room. The more you pour, the more it flows. So you want more? raise your glass. You want more hope? You want more peace in your life? You want more contentment in your life? You want more, more, more than you pour, pour, pour. Bring that empty jar and watch my God fill it up. Amen. Yeah.